is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
35 and flying high from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grahamian Report. Actually, Matt, I was about a day nigh because tomorrow is the big day, but I'm glad to be here in the pocket tonight for this week's edition of the Grahamian Report. Micah Hanks, your host as always, and joined, as always, once again by the Grahamian Reverend himself, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Good evening to you, sir.
Good evening to you as well.
I see you're providing ceremonial beverages for tonight's installment of the program. Many thanks.
Ample amounts.
That's right. And we've got ample amounts of news and other things going on tonight. Looking ahead, mystery earthquakes rattling the Northeast. We've also got what may end up being, in the eventual sense, the first outer space hotel. But turning our attention away to things of greater note, perhaps, in recent days, and perhaps on a sad note, the loss of a radio icon. You knew him probably well if you were a listener of late-night radio like we are. In fact, I think most people in this genre know who I'm talking about. More on that in just a bit, as well as one of the most fascinating articles based on a scientific theory. And this one was tailor-made for Whovians that was reported over the weekend. I can't count how many people sent this to me. Can't wait to dive into it with all you guys, though. So more on that in just a bit. Great to be here, as always. Oh, and hi to everybody there in the chat room. I see they're all kind of filing in. Look at this very cosmic-looking image of Matthew Oakley that they're putting in there.
You just missed your own, too. So you didn't get left out.
I didn't. Oh, look at that. There I am. Yeah, there I am looking sexy as always.
There
with,
I am.
With my very massive microphone. I don't use that mic anymore. That was the good old V900, which was my great big large diaphragm condenser microphone. We used that for the first 6 or 7 years of the Grahamian Report, and I finally upgraded to the Heil PR40. Might as well go ahead and just say, part of the reason that I use this microphone, Grahamian X subscribers of the weekend already heard a little about this. My affinity for this microphone, and I think a lot of broadcasters' similar affection for it, stems from its use by the late, great Art Bell, who we lost last week. And again, I don't think he could have timed it any better had he tried. The host of Late Night Radio extraordinaire, and one of the creepiest programs in all history as far as late night radio goes. Of course, he was the original host of Coast to Coast AM. He passes away on Friday the 13th. Unbelievable. And yet so cosmically fitting, huh?
Absolutely. You know, it was such an interesting day. I love Friday the 13th. I usually go and watch all my Jason movies, admittedly, because I'm a sucker for that kind of, you know, garbage of the mind, but I did not this week. I did, however, get a giant kick out of Neil deGrasse Tyson's tweet. Did you see that?
I didn't, no.
Where he said, I don't know why everybody's so excited about Friday the 13th. It's no more common than Thursday the 12th.
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, that's true. But here's the thing, Neil. We're always having to correct you on your tweets. I even had this in the show notes the other day, that Neil deGrasse Tyson is always being called out for things he tweets. I think he's the kind of guy who likes to tweet first and ask questions later. But the thing is that Friday the 13th, it's not the fact that it's so unusual that the 13th falls on a Friday. It is the fact that that superstition is associated with that number, not the number 12. Neil, come on. I like Neil Tyson, but, you know, again, he gets picked on so much for things that he tweets that he incorporates criticisms about his Twitter usage into his live speeches and things he does.
You gotta see, I love it. It's just cheeky, you know. He's not being a jerk about it or anything. That's a true statement, and it's a joke for people who take a second to get it, right?
Of course.
But people criticize everything these days. It blows my mind. It's like, can't we have a little bit of fun?
No.
Do the pleasure police really have to govern every part of our lives?
Apparently
now?
They do. At least in the minds of, well, those who they deputize themselves as being the so-called pleasure police, like you said there. Again, have some fun. Allow some humor. Don't take everything so seriously. Don't be offended by everything. That's kind of my mantra. And in fact, during hour two, when we remember the late, great Art Bell and some of his most raucous radio exploits, I think we're going to see that there was an awful lot of intentional humor in what he was doing as a radio broadcaster, which unfortunately was lost on some of his more serious-minded listenership, and I think he loved it. I think that that was what was so brilliant about that guy. Look, if you're going to do a program that deals with fringe stuff and the unexplained, you can't take it all seriously. You know that there are certain subjects in this genre that I take extremely seriously. I mean,
A lot of them.
As it relates to UFOs, and again, it's sad that that whole paradigm somewhat shifted beginning back around Christmas last year, that it took the New York Times and the Washington Post and other newspapers reporting on UFOs seriously for other people to feel like it was okay, we've been given the signal, now we can treat it seriously too. You know, it just goes to show, I mean, I don't like to use terms like sheeple, but I mean, that really is kind of what this involves. People who they follow because they don't know how to function otherwise. But as soon as they're given a clear indication that it's okay to think or believe or do or wear something or to eat something or to believe something, they will do it. And Art Bell, you know, was one of those guys who he made fun of a lot of that. At times, he was very serious about the things he discussed, but I think that more often than not, as you will see later, there was a brilliant kind of humor to that guy. So a lot else was going on over the weekend. Unfortunately, it was one where I worked the entire time, and I dropped the big 35 earlier, that's true. Despite having a voice that doesn't seem to fit my face, according to those who meet me, they say, you sound so much older when we hear you, and then we see this young guy. Well, you know, I'm not that young anymore, because as of tomorrow, Matt, I turn 35.
That's right. That's right. That's why I bought all the Guinness, the ample Guinness.
I'm officially not going to be a young guy anymore. I've not felt young for a long time, ladies and gents, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I relish in my old age despite being of young disposition, and I think this is one reason why I'm often compared to that great spacefaring and space-time doctor.
Well, I started to say that's part of being a Time Lord, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, if you feel older than time itself, you've seen the birth of stars and the collapse of galaxies and entire civilizations, and yet you look like you're a dude in his 30s who might be from England.
It could be worse.
Could be worse indeed. I relish it. I'm so thankful to be who I am, where I am, and with the company I keep. Elsewhere, though, things have been a little shaky. No pun intended, because those in the village of McAdam near New Brunswick have been plagued by an unusual number of earthquakes in recent weeks. It's been reported, and according to sources in the area, there have been more than 20 of these earthquakes in the last month alone. As yet, there is no cause that has been determined, but this isn't the first time that this kind of thing has happened. In fact, this current earthquake swarm is similar to circumstances that began back in early 2016. Over the course of that year alone, perhaps more than 100 of these earthquakes were reported in that very same area. Now, it was reported over the weekend that many homeowners have described the quakes that shook their homes at night. They woke up many residents. A few have claimed that windows and things in their homes have even been broken. And as strange and as sudden as the onset of these quakes has been, it's equally strange that they are intermittent and that for the entire last year, there were no such quakes after the 2016 wave. All things were quiet and seemed to have settled until the last month when we've had 20 of them, according to recent counts. Many residents have also described, and you know this is what will catch my attention, Matt, loud, mysterious booms that coincide with these quakes, which have been compared to the sounds of a gunshot, but the residents who hear it say that they actually are louder. So imagine you're laying there awake at night, you hear something louder than a gunshot, a massive explosive crack in the night, you feel your house shaking, you wake up and you find windows broken. You can understand why residents would be upset about something like this.
One would think so.
Now, the mayor of McAdams, Ken Stanix, was quoted over the weekend saying, "It will wake you up in the middle of the night, but we've become accustomed to them because they happen so frequently." He said, "You wake up and you say, that must have been an earthquake, and then you'll hear a couple softer bangs, and then the event is over." Seismologists at the Natural Resources Canada outpost have confirmed that there are no faults in the area, and therefore they say there's no reason for them to be able to explain why the area is getting swarms of earthquakes. They don't associate it with typical seismic activity. And this is pretty customary among the reports of mystery booms that occur up there in the Northeast. Despite there not being an area that is conducive, seismic, geologically otherwise, to earthquakes, a lot of them happen there. And yet, people at the USGS over the years, just as well as Natural Resources Canada, have said that nothing is actually registering in many of these instances on the Richter scale. Why are there loud booms being heard, shaking being felt, but they aren't actually detecting earthquakes? It seems that there's something else going on here. Now, there are a lot of theories about things like this in the colder weather months. And keep in mind, we don't have record low temperatures here in the Appalachians right now, but it's colder for April than we're used to seeing. Usually by this time of the year, and actually above ground, Matt, it looks quite nice outside today. I ventured forth. I went and I did my due diligence. I pulled a Jack Burton, you know. You know what I say each year around tax season? Checks in the mail. I hope to say that at least by the time the taxes are actually due, and so this year I did.
Who's Jack Burton?
Who's Jack Burton? I'm Jack Burton. Yeah. So the checks, both of them, yeah. The one to the feds and the one to the state, yeah, they're both in the mail. It's beautiful looking outside, I have to say, even for a glum day like tax day. Well, it's tomorrow, so I'm a little ahead of the game. But it's cold out there for April.
And it was such a nice weekend. It almost hit 80 here, and now we're back down to like 35.
I know. It's weird. It's really weird. And so the fact that these quakes, or whatever you want to call them, they're very similar to earthquakes. The fact that they are continuing on, if you looked at the forecast over the weekend, there was this bizarre weather front up over the Midwest and the northeastern United States, Matt, where, I mean, a lot of people in a lot of states are still being pounded with snow. Anybody out there listening in one of these areas being affected by the unusually late season cold weather, we'd like to hear from you. info@graylearingreport.com, info@micahhanks.com. Send us a note. We'd like to hear from you. Or you could always join our fine folks there in the chat room at kgraradio.com/chat. You may be prompted to submit an email and a password, but then you can log in, interact with all the fine folks in there, like my lovely assistant Lauren, Mr. Nasty, and of course the Grayland Reverend himself. Bill's in there also in the chat. I'm here. A lot of folks. So, as far as what I think's going on in the Northeast, I couldn't tell you. I mean, a lot of things run through my mind due to the fact that the Northeast has such a historic precedent for the existence of these booms. Back in the 1970s, late 70s, there was a wave of mystery booms that were reported. And even Carl Sagan, Matt, got interested in this, and he went to the then-head president of the Federation of American Scientists and said, you've got to try and figure out what's going on, because a lot of conspiracy theorists at that time said that there was some sort of weather manipulation technology at work. They believed that it was probably high-altitude storms, and that this high-altitude storm phenomena could produce lightning that may not be visible at ground level, and thunder that accompanied it, but it would be louder than thunder if it were accompanying what are known as super bolts, okay, super lightning bolts. If you go online and look up what's called the Bell Island Boom, this is one of those things. We actually did an entire story about this on Graylean Report a few years ago, looking at that famous Bell Island Boom, and a lot of weird things were reported coinciding with that. Not only were there flashes of light and these loud mystery booms, but there were also manifestations of ball lightning. So it did seem to pretty strongly suggest that there was something akin to, you know, an atmospheric origin for a lot of those booms. But sometimes shallow earthquakes and things like that can cause these sorts of booms. And as I've alluded, with the holdover of cold weather in the Northeast and the Midwest here all the way into April, yeah, cryosasms or frost quakes might also be part of what's occurring here. And I would say that it may even be more likely than normal due to the fact that we have warming temperatures, and then we see a cooling trend, and then it gets warm again, and then it gets cold. Because when that happens, what you'll often see is that the ground that has been frozen throughout the winter months further north will begin to thaw. And if there is a saturation of ground water that freezes again quickly, that's what causes the cryosasm. It can actually produce a explosive pop or boom when the ground actually splits due to the pressure from the freezing that occurs. So that may be what's going on. You know, in the chat room there, X-Lady's saying that she's in northwestern Pennsylvania. She says all of our temps are in the 30s, and we may even get snow tonight. Wow. It's crazy. Lorraine's there also. She says, I think she's probably referring to the mystery booms wave, I think 1978. She said it was never mentioned in my geology classes. What a shame that it's noteworthy. Susan there says, in the northern part of this country, we had light snow. I'm in the southern part, so no snow here. I can tell you no snow here in Appalachia, but it's probably going to be cold enough tonight that it could happen. Let's hope not. You know, Matt, if it gets too much colder, we may have to head north ourselves, but not to the northeast where it's actually going to be frigid. I'm thinking we might have to go off planet for a little while.
Really?
Yeah, although we're probably going to have millions of dollars to be able to do this. Jeremy pointed this out to me over the weekend, that there's something interesting that was announced during the recent Space 2.0 summit that occurred in San Jose, California, the Aurora Station Project, as it's called, which plans to allow six individuals and an accompanying crew to enjoy first-class accommodations in space. So we could be Graylians in space.
I mean, we need to start a GoFundMe now, though.
Well, yeah, because it's going to cost millions. They say along with virtual reality experiments, as well as studies that are going to involve growing food in space, they're going to be doing science up there, too. But Sky News reports that the, quote, once-in-a-lifetime experience will allow guests to experience the exhilaration of zero gravity and gaze upon stunning views of the planet below without the fear of getting lost in space, with the added perk of being able to witness an average of 16 sunrises and sunsets a day. Well, that would be nice. I like the pop culture reference they made there. There's the new Netflix series. We'll have to come back around and talk about that and the criticism that Lost in Space has been receiving.
I've seen a lot of it. I haven't caught it yet. I didn't realize it went live until yesterday, so
I haven't had a chance to watch the series. All I've seen is people complaining about it, as usual, because that's what people do. Now, Frank Bunger, chief executive officer and developer of Orion Span, said that the hotel would open in 2021 and host its first guests the following year. He said, "We developed Aurora Station to provide a turnkey destination in space. Upon launch, Aurora Station goes into service immediately, bringing travelers into space quicker and at a lower lower price point than ever seen before, while still providing an unforgettable experience." Now, he says lower price point, but I happen to know that each person is going to be billed around $9.5 million. When they go up there. A trip to the Aurora Station will still require a three-month training regime as well. Now, those keen to take part and with a few quid to spare can already put down an $80,000 deposit online in a bid to secure a place. But Mr. Bunger, who set up Orion Span to, quote, build and sustain human communities in space, said that there was more to the project than providing a unique holiday destination. He says Aurora Station is incredibly versatile and has multiple uses beyond serving as a hotel. We're going to offer full charters to space agencies who are looking to achieve human spaceflight in orbit for a fraction of the cost and only pay for what they use. He said, "Well, we will support zero gravity research as well as in-space manufacturing. Our architecture is such that we can easily add capacity, enabling us to grow with market demand like a city growing skyward on Earth." It's pretty neat. Right here in Asheville, North Carolina, years ago, our city council was really upset, Matt, about the idea of adding some new skyscrapers. I brought this up in the past because they want to preserve the Asheville skyline. Almost quoted my favorite Bob Dylan album title there. Yeah, they wanted to preserve the skyline of our little city of Asheville. And I thought, but you know, here's the thing about that. If you're concerned about things like urban sprawl, as you should be in a mountain town in the beautiful wilderness of the Pisgah National Forest and, you know, the greater Appalachians, I mean, shouldn't you be, I guess I'll put it this way, isn't it preferable that you would go up, okay, rather than out with your building? And so I'm actually a fan of building up and maybe not building, you know, something like the Burj Dubai, you know, the Burj Khalifa, these massive super buildings that are so large that really they serve no functional purpose apart from just being really big. And I mean, I think it goes without saying, in post 9/11 America, we know what can happen, okay, in the worst circumstances to large buildings. So have several smaller buildings that are still large, just not, you know, massive, not Tower of Babel kind of things, but, you know, build up, not out.
Well, that's been a controversy for a long time, if real estate only applies to a certain height, or, you know, I've heard debates on that for a long time, and it's actually kind of interesting. Did you ever see the remake of Total Recall?
With
Colin Farrell?
No, I didn't. I don't think.
They build way up, so they're like apartment buildings. It's almost like the Inception type deal where they fold the earth over and you can look up in the sky and there's more buildings pointing quote unquote downward.
I see. Yeah.
So yeah, I always get that imagery, but that's a big controversy though, is how high up does real estate actually go?
Well, that's the question. I mean, but I would argue that if you build up rather than out, you can make better use of space, because there's only so far that you can go out, so much space here on terra firma that you can build upon. But if we do build up, and I don't know, I mean, all concerns about terrorism and things like that aside, maybe taller buildings will be in the eventual future, because people will begin to realize that, I mean, there's more housing that can be afforded, And not just housing. I mean, you know, there's also space for recreation, restaurants, you know, employment, all kinds of things. Gyms, nightclubs, gardens. That's another thing that I think I'd like to see a lot more of is gardening in the future where we can utilize space that is not necessarily ground-based. Well, but you'd think you'd have to, you know, do your gardening on the ground because that's where the soil is, right? Well, but what if you could actually do multi-leveled gardening operations? You know, innovative designs that will allow for daylight to hit multi-tiered structures where gardening can occur on multiple levels, and all of a sudden, vast regions of land aren't necessarily required for farming. Eventually, these kind of things are going to have to happen. I'm sure somebody's already working on that. We're just kind of spitballing here, but you know, looking ahead to the future, it's not just going to be space tourism that we're going to be seeing. I mean, I think in the eventual sense, many are saying we're going to have to get off planet in order to survive. I think there's also a lot that we can do right here on Earth that would be beneficial to more inhabitants as we're seeing population growth over the decades.
Well, there's also the, we've talked about it on the show before, Asgardia, the colony of space that they're taking names, and they've sent data up into space already with their own satellites. I like the idea of a space hotel a little bit more. It sounds a little less cultish, and Asgardia really has some weird niches it's trying to fill.
Oh, it really does. I mean, and I think they are getting ahead of themselves, or maybe we would say above themselves. I don't know. I think Jeremy brings up the best point, though, right there in the chat room. He says, if there ain't bourbon, I ain't going. I think I agree. You know, another thing about space that has always fascinated me, Matt, is that we're talking about how we've got to get off planet in order to survive. And I do think that from time to time there's a bit of fear-mongering when it comes to that subject, and that we really need to kind of pare back on that and see how we can improve the quality of life and the ability to farm and the utilization of resources here before we start saying, oh my God, we've got to find a new home. Last time I checked, you know, we hadn't lost everything in terms of this one yet. But I will say that one of the other benefits of getting off planet is going to be the eventual discovery of life that exists elsewhere out there. If it is intelligent, if it is, technologically advanced and we hope civilized, we may be able to learn things from them. And that's going to be, if not a likelihood, it's going to be an almost inevitability. I mean, many scientists are saying, we've reported on this too on the program, that within the next 100 years, at very least, we're going to find evidence of life out there. But now here's the thing. A lot of scientists are saying that we may be going about it wrong. In the search for alien life, astronomers, they look for a lot of different things. They include everything from habitable stars and distant galaxies to possible radio signals that might be produced by aliens on faraway worlds. And enough time has passed, keep in mind, that aliens on worlds, perhaps not unlike our own, could be tuning into earthly broadcasts already. They might be hearing early transmissions of Earth music and other programming that we produced here decades ago. And so it stands to reason that we might do the same in the eventual sense. That is, pick up on their transmissions and find evidence of alien life, whether or not we're actually communicating with them. If we're talking about radio signals, it's going to take an awful long time for those signals to propagate and make their way here. But not everybody thinks that the current SETI programs are the best approach to finding proof of extraterrestrial life. In fact, it may be that due to problems with human preconceptions about aliens, many scientists will be prone to what some call inattentional blindness, which may actually be preventing us from going about the search for aliens in the most effective ways. Sputnik News reported on this, and they said that a group of psychologists from the University of Cadiz in Spain has published an article criticizing alien-seeking scientists involved in the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence project, saying that they'll never make contact with extraterrestrial civilizations, period, at least if they continue on the way that they have. The psychologists also criticized the so-called Kardashev scale used to classify civilizations in space based on their power usage. According to the Kardashev scale, first proposed by Soviet astronomer Nikolai Kardashev in 1964, civilizations rated at 1 use all the resources of their own planet. Civilizations rated at 2 use all the energy of their parent star, and a Type 3 civilization can utilize the energy and resources of their whole galaxy. Now, you hear Michio Kaku talk about this often. The psychologists involved with this study instead offered their own kind of scale built on the ability of a civilization to alter its environment. They said humanity is still dependent on the natural conditions of the Earth, vulnerable to global catastrophes and still subject to the governing rules of biological evolution. At the same time, humans are relatively close to becoming space colonists and using the fruits of genetic engineering and nuclear physics. This makes humanity stuck between the first and the second stage of their scale. A Type 2 civilization should have control over quantum and gravitational energy, space-time, and the ability to explore galaxies, while a Type 3 civilization would be made up of exotic, immortal beings with the power to traverse multiple dimensions and manipulate dark energy and matter. A lot of interesting things that are being said there. That study, by the way, appeared in Acta Astronautica. But they bring up some very interesting points. And one of them is the fact that they say that a civilization that reaches Type 2 should be able to essentially do all the things that we see UFOs doing. And that if they are a Type 3 civilization, that if UFOs were representative of that, that they indeed could be traversing dimensional boundaries, not just traveling across distances in space. Let me read that again. A Type 2 civilization should have control over quantum and gravitational energy, space-time, and the ability to explore galaxies. It's pretty far out stuff. Some would argue, though, that whether or not it's our own technology, that it does exist, and I'm not sure what it all is, what it all means, what the truth is, what the reality behind the UFO phenomena is. If these things, as described in the USS Nimitz incident and others like that, if these things are actual vehicles, and this is not some sort of a strange atmospheric phenomena, I mean, I find it really hard to believe that we could say that something that is shaped like a giant Tic Tac and capable of maneuverability that far exceeds that of our most advanced military and naval jets. I mean, this has got to be some kind of a technology that somebody has. So let's say it's here on Earth and that somebody here on Earth has this technology. Well, what if then we're looking at something that was either brought here from elsewhere or that we acquired? This has been a long-held conspiracy theory as it relates to UFOs, that we captured flying saucer technology, kept it in a bunker down there at Area 51 for years. We'd only hear whispers about this over time, or from time to time it'd be frantic crying from people who'd call into late-night programs like Coast to Coast and tell Art Bell all about what was happening. The stories about things going on at Area 51 would often involve ideas like back-engineering spacecraft. This was Bob Lazar's entire story. And although a lot of Lazar's narrative has been discredited, many say that he sounds credible despite being discredited, and that there could be some truths and also some untruths to stories like that. It's kind of hard to know what's going on. But again, if a lot of these military witness testimonies about UFO sightings and interactions are representative of interactions with actual physical aircraft of some kind, we have to presume somebody has this technology. And whether here or there, in other words, whether we built it here and it's being kept from the general public for whatever reason, or somebody from somewhere else flew here using these craft, I mean, maybe we are seeing some of the evidences of these Type 2 civilizations, at very least.
And the interesting thing, and I actually saw an article earlier I'd like to tie this to, is how dangerous is it if we don't discover the technology for ourselves, if we do, quote-unquote, back-engineer it to some degree, right? We don't have the kind of responsibility it took to gain that technology. There was a recent article run I saw today that scientists are now worried about finding extraterrestrial life. Now, admittedly, they're talking about microbiological life on places like Mars. NASA has searched for 40 years, and yet here in the next couple of years, people like Elon Musk plan to send astronauts over to Mars and start colonizing it, right? They're going to contaminate it before we can actually find any life. We are contaminating the galaxy to some degree if we are using certain technologies without the responsibility of gaining the knowledge for ourselves.
Remember the quote we had from last week, one of the astronauts talking about how he believed that, you know, what the ancient Sumerians talked about is most likely, that somebody flew here, they came here. But it wouldn't necessarily have to be intelligent aliens coming and colonizing Earth in ancient times and then building a new civilization. I mean, I'm not saying that didn't happen here on Earth. I'm just saying that evolutionary history and biological studies seem to point to something else. But at very least, we could contaminate another world and maybe life would end up there as a result. More when we return here on the Graylian Report. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report, keeping our eyes on the skies, making sure that doomsday is not around the corner, as one theorist has been saying. I don't buy it, and I don't think a lot of other folks out there, experts in the field, buy it either. Matt, do you believe that Nibiru, the proverbial Planet X, is going to be bringing about a doomsday anytime soon?
Well, you know, we've been told that it's going to about 13 times over the past year, I think. So maybe, you know, maybe they hit a home run this time.
14 is the lucky mark, I suppose. Well, again, if you follow popular doom porn that turns up all the time on tabloid news sites like this, you probably heard about David Mead. He calls himself, at least, a Christian numerologist who has made claims in the past about doomsday predictions involving this so-called planet Nibiru that I mentioned. And recently, Mead offered up an updated version of his standing doomsday predictions for the Nibiru cataclysm. The Daily Express reported that Mead told them that the rogue planet will appear in the sky, wait for it, Matt, this April 23rd, heralding the end of the world. Where's that end of the world thing?
Again.
Yeah, we need to get our end of the world soundbite here. Matt, you hear that? On April 23rd, the world is going to end. Oh my God, what if he's right this time? Well, fortunately for all of us, I don't think that he will be. The Inquisitor reports that while NASA has repeatedly gone on record to debunk the conspiracy theory, the U.S. Space Agency isn't the only institution or individual willing to break down Mead's statements and point out why the world won't be ending, contrary to popular or unpopular belief, depending on how you look at it, on the date he specified, just as it didn't on the days that he had previously predicted. Newsweek even commented on this. They said that the theory of the Nibiru cataclysm originated in 1995 from Zeta Talk website founder Nancy Leiter. Recent years, however, have seen David Mead as the leading Nibiru conspiracy theorist, having released a book last year titled Planet X, the 2017 Arrival, and making several predictions of when the cataclysmic event will take place. You would think that, I mean, looking at all the times in the past that people have been wrong about predictions like this, if you put out a book claiming that the end of the world is going to happen within the next year, you're going to be held accountable. Even if I thought the world was going to end, Matt, I wouldn't go out there and write a book about it and claim that.
Especially, you can't really capitalize on it.
Well,
you know?
No, you can. That's just it. Enough people out there, enough dumb people probably would buy the book.
Well,
but then hold on. When the world didn't end, look what's going to happen. People are going to come back and they're going to say, okay, whatever happened to the end of the world? No, it's a little troubling to me, by the way, that there are people who would want to buy a book about the end of the world, hoping that the world will actually end within the next year. But when it doesn't, inevitably, you've got to put yourself in Mead's shoes. Do you want to be that guy who was wrong time and time and time again?
Well, that's the thing, is either A, you don't get to capitalize on it at all because you're right, right? And yeah, you rake in $1 million, but the world ends and doesn't really matter, does it?
Didn't really think this through, did I?
Or you just set up a brilliant plan and well, sorry, guys, my calculations were off. Wait for the next book where I correct myself. Okay.
Yeah. How many more books will he sell before people finally figure out this guy is a fraud?
Well, yeah, I'm with Bill here in the chat room. If he starts serving the Kool-Aid, run.
That's
pretty close to accurate, I think.
There is some precedent for these kind of things. There really is. Now, Newsweek observed that Mead's forecasts utilize what he calls biblical gymnastics. I don't know if he calls them that. I think Newsweek did, but these involve references to the Book of Revelation, which he then associates with planetary alignments and the purported arrival of Nibiru, a.k.a. Planet X. Now, without getting to all this, you know, fringe history that involves belief in this, you know, in Zechariah Sitchin and all these kind of things, I'm just commenting on this story. Realize we could go way deeper down this rabbit hole.
And it's numerology, too, isn't it?
Well, yes, and we'll come around to that. It's not very good numerology, if that's what he calls it. But the Washington Post even chimes in on this, though, saying that Mead's Nibiru cataclysm predictions have regularly been pushed by a number of UK tabloids, many of which supposedly make use of sensationalist copy to suggest that the world might be, and supposedly, no, they do, they absolutely do that. We report on that every week. Citing Mead, these publications' reports often hint at various types of natural disasters, war, and other fantastical events that are supposed to take place when Planet X appears in the sky. But with Mead's latest forecast hinting that the world will end later this month, a number of experts issued statements to reassure readers that the apocalypse is not coming in about a week or so. But I'll just point this out, Matt, and I think this will be the final word about all that. As far as the book of Revelation, from which Meade draws many of his current predictions, I mean, we should point out that it's been wrong plenty of times in the past. It's not very likely, in other words, that Meade and his Nibiru predictions will be correct this time either. At least, not for my part. I'm not counting on it. And I certainly don't think that by the end of April, we're going to be seeing a great, big, giant, weird alien planet in the sky bringing about apocalypse here on Earth. At least not until hell freezes over, right? Which it may be doing outside. More in a moment when we return here on the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe, and in all quadrants of space-time via KGRARadio.com, the planet, just not Nibiru. Now, I do have an interesting question that has been on my mind. We've just got barely enough time in this segment to get to this. We'll have to allow a little of this conversation to spill over into the next hour. I couldn't count how many times over the weekend people emailed me this article, and for the Atlantic, Matt, it was certainly an interesting piece. The title alone says it all. Was there a civilization on Earth before humans?
No.
A Look at the Available Evidence by Adam Frank.
I was joking. I'm not really that dismissive.
It only took 5 minutes for Gavin Schmidt to outspeculate me, Adam writes. Schmidt is the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, a world-class climate science facility. One day last year, I came to GISS with a far-out proposal. In my work as an astrophysicist, I'd begun researching global warming from an astrobiological perspective. That meant asking whether any industrial civilization that rises on any planet will, through their own activity, trigger their own version of a climate shift. I was visiting GISS that day, hoping to gain some climate science insights and perhaps collaborators. That's how I ended up in Gavin's office. And just as I was revving up my pitch, Gavin stopped me in my tracks. Wait a second, he said. How do you know we're the only time there's been a civilization on our own planet? Well, it took me a few seconds to pick my jaw up off the floor. I'd certainly come into Gavin's office prepared for eye rolls at the mention of exo-civilizations. Now, why would you roll your eyes at something like that? He goes on to say, though, that but the civilizations he was asking about would have existed many millions of years ago. And sitting there seeing Earth's vast evolutionary past telescope before my mind's eye, I felt a kind of temporal vertigo. Yeah, I stammered. Could we tell if there'd been an industrial civilization that deep in time? Now, as a brief aside here, this is a question that has been asked many times, and it has taken many shapes in different arguments over the years. I think Graham Hancock, you know, the crux of his argument, really kind of borrowing from the mythology surrounding fictitious, I believe, places like Atlantis, at least begs the question that whether or not it was a different civilization than modern humans as we know them today, could there have been civilized societies in earlier times that existed? Iterations of technological revolutions, perhaps on smaller scales, but technological revolutions nonetheless, which occurred at earlier times. Could some of these extend back to around the time of or before the end of the last ice age? That's one take on this. And then we look at the so-called out-of-place artifacts, and authors like Brad Steiger, I remember fondly reading Brad's book as a child, Worlds Before Our Own. And the claim, of course, in that book was that there was evidence that suggested that there were strange things. There are locations like the Oklo Mines in Africa, which some suggest appear to be a natural nuclear reactor. How would that come about, one would ask? Well, again, you've got an encasement of granite or some sort of a similar stone structure in which there is a deposit of radioactive, apparently naturally occurring radioactive element concentration, which is cooled naturally by spring water, and hence there's a natural reactor. But some would say, is that really what this is, or is this the remnant of a man-made, or that one, if it wasn't man, if somebody or something built one long ago on Earth, is this how it would remain and appear today, after perhaps the passage of millions of years? So a lot of these questions, and the likely solution to all of them is no, there weren't people, or at very least civilizations, that occurred here on Earth before our own. But it is an interesting question, and I was fascinated to see an article like this, that the subject would even be broached in the Atlantic. That's pretty fascinating stuff. And the article goes on to explore that possibility. When we come back after this break, I do want to look at that a little bit with the weird temporal displacement we've experienced during the broadcast tonight. I think it's only right that we save some of this discussion for the next segment. But I do want to look at what they call the Silurian hypothesis. What does that have to do with space-time, time travel, Doctor Who, and worlds before our own? We'll look at all of that when we return on the Graylian Report.
Hi, this is Jimmy Church of Fade to Black. You're listening to Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report.
You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Van Buren, Arkansas, Sarasota, Florida.
Is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia, broadcasting worldwide around the globe via KGRAradio.com, I spoke too soon, Matt. You know, I joke around about hell freezing over, and then he comes back in here and tells me it's snowing upstairs.
That's right.
Well, I will learn one of these days. Anyhow, welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. Glad you guys are here in pocket with us. I can't believe it's actually snowing outside in April. Fun fact, on the day I was born, 35 years ago tomorrow, it snowed. What goes around comes around, or I guess in the Appalachian Mountains, it blows around. But if you haven't gotten around yet to subscribing to Graylian X, it's fun and easy to do. Head over to graylianreport.com/X. There you can sign up. You can get access to additional shows that we put out every week, as well as monthly specials like Graylian X, Graylian Enigmas. And we've got an upcoming feature, something that we've done occasionally in the past that is going to be a new supplemental program that you guys will be able to enjoy. More on that in the coming weeks. We're in the process of getting that together right now, but lots to enjoy for Graylian X subscribers. Do head on over, check that out. And while you're there at graylianreport.com, pay attention to the right-hand column over there. You'll see a link that says how to podcast, and you can learn too, just like anybody. We had to learn here in the bunker. Yeah, even Matt has to learn from time to time. He fortunately has access to a fine handbook that tells you all the ins and the outs of podcasting the Maverick way.
Yeah, you actually never gave me a copy of that book, by the way.
Well, thanks for ruining the illusion.
Hey, you know, I've just been complaining about this for so long, and I figured one of these days you got to get it to me, right?
Well, if you head on over to Amazon.com, Matt, you don't have to wait.
That's true. I could do that.
I might even sign your copy for you.
Really?
If you're really good.
Awesome.
Yeah. I don't know. Since he brought all of this delicious, dark Guinness over here in celebration of the Big 3-5, maybe I could work out a trade with him.
Sounds good to me.
Hey, listen, I want to say, though, thank you. A lot of you have already been sending along birthday wishes. My lovely assistant, whom helps me behind the scenes in more ways than I could probably count, she had sent a gift box the other day, and one of the things in it, and this is, she's so good at picking out appropriate gifts. And since we talk about cryptozoology a lot on this show, she got me one of the nice little double-insulated Yeti, one of the little 10-ounce guys, but this is perfect because I can put coffee in it. It's not one of these huge koozie kind of things that you're going to carry with you out on a day on the lake, but you can put coffee in it in the mornings, or you could put an old-fashioned in it at night. She knows, of course, I just like drinking out of it because it's called a Yeti. But she sent that also in a Padron number 9. I don't smoke often, but when I do, by Jove, I enjoy a good Maduro, sir.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that cigar. Love it.
Yeah, so thank you, Lauren. That was so nice of you. Jeremy, of course, was sending along accolades. Miss Nancy Rocks, my good pal over across the pond in England, she sent along happy birthday wishes, and a lot of other folks too, but you know, Matt also appearing tonight with societal beverages. So all of you guys who've already said so, thank you very much. But don't forget, my little brother Caleb, he also is celebrating his birthday tomorrow. That's right. He and I share the same birthday, but 3 years apart. And if you head over there to theclerkchronicles.com, Caleb has a new EP, a new album out with some music that I'm sure that everybody would really enjoy. If you haven't heard it already, you should go check that out. But I'd like to see if we could do something neat. For those who do like what they hear and would like to purchase a copy of that album, maybe we could get some people, get some interest in Caleb's project going on. And as a birthday gift to little bro, we can sell a few copies of the Clerk. And you're welcome to drop a line to him on Twitter, etc. Let him know that you heard about that on the Graylian Report, but I hope Caleb has a great birthday too. Let's just hope we aren't all snowed in, right? Because if we are, Matt, I'm going to have to go pick up my copy of Worlds Before Our Own and see what I can find about that. But I want to come back to Adam Frank's article that appeared over the weekend there at The Atlantic. Picking up where he left off, he said, you know, we never got back to aliens. Instead, the first conversation that we discussed launched a new study that we've recently published in the International Journal of Astrobiology. And though neither of us could see it at the moment, Gavin's penetrating question opened a window, not just onto Earth's past. That question, of course, being what if there were civilizations here on terra firma before our own? No, this also had a lot to do with the future. If you'd like to read this article, we're not going to read the whole thing. I just want to kind of paraphrase it here. But if you go over to my Twitter page, at Micah Hanks, I'm one of those lucky guys with his actual name as his Twitter handle. But head over to at Micah Hanks on Twitter, and you'll see I tweeted this over the weekend. Now, Frank says, when it comes to direct evidence of an industrial civilization, things like cities, factories, and roads, the geologic record doesn't go back past what's called the Quaternary period, 2.6 million years ago. For example, the oldest large-scale stretch of ancient surface lies in the Negev Desert. It's just 1.8 million years old. Older surfaces are mostly visible in cross-section via something like a cliff face or rock cuts. See, the Seven Ages guys and I know a lot about this kind of a thing, especially James Waldo, our geologist. You go back much further than the Quaternary, and everything has been turned over and crushed to dust. And if we're going back this far, we're not talking about human civilizations anymore. Homo sapiens didn't even make their appearance on the planet until just 300,000 years or so ago. And that means the question shifts to other species. Hey, Matt, Homo habilis, perhaps?
I think maybe so.
You know, I really think you might, or even better, we have this one, which is why Gavin called the idea the Silurian hypothesis after an old Doctor Who episode, which featured intelligent reptiles that lived below ground. Now, I can tell you from experience, folks, the below-Earth dwellers are not reptilians like what you see in Doctor Who, but the Time Lords do mingle with inner-Earth dwellers at times nonetheless. And so Adam says, could researchers find clear evidence that an ancient species built a relatively short-lived industrial civilization long before our own? Perhaps, for example, some early mammal rose briefly to civilization building during the Paleocene epoch about 60 million years ago. There are fossils, of course, but the fraction of life that gets fossilized is always minuscule and varies a lot depending on time and habitat. It would be easy, therefore, to miss an industrial civilization that only lasted 100,000 years, which would be 500 times longer than our industrial civilization has made it so far. I want you to think about that for a moment, people. Again, how little fossil evidence might exist of a civilization that had lived 500 times longer than we as an industrial civilization already have. Here's some more food for thought, and something that I did myself a while back. I went online and I just decided to look for fossil evidence of modern humans. I mean, granted, it's going to take a while for fossil evidence to accumulate for a species, but there isn't very much of it. And depending on the region, the conditions, the environment, a number of factors, there are probably species that have come and gone. Without question, there are species that have come and gone on this planet, large, small, aquatic, land-dwelling, etc., avian for that matter, which have come and gone, and for which there is not going to be a representation in the fossil record that tells us about their existence. We have a good idea of the diversity of biology on this planet and how it changes over time in what we do have access to in the fossil record, but given the consideration that very, very specific circumstances are requisite before a fossil can even be formed, to think that we can account for all the species on this planet in the fossil record alone that have ever existed, that is ridiculous. But you think about this in the context of things like cryptozoology. And again, one of the arguments against the existence of a creature like Bigfoot, or Sasquatch, as we would prefer to say, right, Matt?
Of course.
We don't like Bigfoot. Now, yeah. All kidding aside, Matt and I did a really lengthy discussion on Grailian X a couple of weeks ago where we said, really, again, calling this thing a goofy... There are choice expressions I could use that I can't say on an FCC-moderated broadcast for this, but I'm just going to say calling the thing Bigfoot does it no favors. Okay, nobody's going to take a creature seriously if you call it Bigfoot.
Well, and not just that, but the culture surrounding that specific name at this point,
yes,
has not to be too punny here, but has kind of shot the movement in the foot.
Ha! This guy. But so I think you're right. I think that, again, it's become a culture more of entertainment than of anything that science has ever applied to. Not to say that science shouldn't be applied to it, but when science looks at this question, they say, well, there's nothing to see here, though. There's nothing represented in the fossil record that even begs further inquiry. And I'm thinking, that's a fairly shallow statement, you realize, especially considering that there are ancient human ancestors like Paranthropus that at various times actually did exceed 6 feet in height in different parts of the world. We have robust hominids in the ancient past that were very much like what we are today, but larger, stronger, more primitive. In other words, an awful lot like what we'd expect a Sasquatch to be.
Well, Gigantopithecus, well, a lot of people have said, that's Bigfoot or that's Sasquatch or whatever. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Depends on what school of thought you ascribe to, but that's a clear representation of kind of what we think about.
And all we have in the fossil record that represents that creature is a fragment of a jawbone. Now, granted, we know an awful lot about that creature based on the morphological characteristics of that fragmentary fossil jawbone. True. But I think that in the broader sense, the real point to be made here is that the reason people attribute Gigantopithecus to Sasquatch is because we don't have something else that we have seen in the fossil record that more clearly fits a creature, a type for that creature, or anything similar to it. I don't know that you could make any kind of connection between the two. They may not be related at all. And in fact, there may be a creature far closer to home, something more recently having existed here on Earth, and that we haven't found the fossil yet, if one exists. But then again, like we're talking about with this Silurian hypothesis, it could also be that there simply wasn't a fossil representative, okay, of that species. So again, I want to come back to this. Homo sapiens didn't make their appearance on the planet until just 300,000 years ago. There are fossils, of course, but the fraction of the life on Earth that gets fossilized is always minuscule and varies a lot depending on time and habitat. Again, reading from the Atlantic article, it would be easy to miss an industrial civilization that only lasted 100,000 years, which would be 500 times longer than our industrial civilization has made it so far. To be clear, Okay, they aren't trying to make the case that there was a civilization here on Earth a long time ago, by any means. To the contrary, what they're trying to argue is, well, of course, as a hypothetical kind of a thought experiment, we can learn a lot from asking questions about what would we have to try and find, what would we be looking for to prove something like this. And although it says a lot more about where humanity is heading and what we can expect in the future, I think looking at things like cryptozoology, we can learn as much as we have kind of seen here. So the article is well worth reading, and again, we're not going to read the entire thing here. I will just kind of summarize. The very last little snippet of it says, by asking about civilizations lost in deep time, we're also asking about the possibility for universal rules guiding the evolution of all biospheres in all their creative potential, including the emergence of civilizations. Even without pickup-driving Paleocenians, we're only now learning to see how rich the potential might be. Definitely check it out. It's a great article and definitely something that I think we'll probably revisit again in future installments of the program. Now, that said, in the next segment here, I want to make sure that I'm not missing anything. Yeah, I think we're good. I do want to pay tribute to the old man himself, the late, great Art Bell. Art was quite a... he was an interesting character. You know, he was often very dry-witted, always entertaining. And many would say that as far as talk radio hosts go, he had a certain edge that many today simply do not. And if anything, I think he kind of set a standard for the style of programming that you are listening to right now. Because programs that have an interest in the unexplained, I would say most, if not all of them, borrow essentially from what Art Bell began to do back in the early 1990s, and did for a number of years on the program that came to be known as Coast to Coast AM, still hosted by George Norrie. But again, I want to remember Art Bell here in the next segment. He was quite a colorful character when it came to talk radio. But I think, among other things, an innovator, a true talent, he was also a bit of a trickster, as I think we will see shortly. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay with us. The snowy foothills of Appalachia. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Still amazed. Matt's got the periscope drawn. Snow falling over Appalachia. It is April 16th, 2018. Tomorrow is tax day. I turn 25. I'm sorry, 35 in Earth years. Yeah, sorry, can't get away with that one. As young as I'd like to feel.
Yeah, well, at least you tried.
Well, it's kind of funny because it's snowing again. There are flowers blooming. I have jonquils coming up in my yard, and it's piling snow up outside. I just don't know what to think about this. Again, I said earlier, though, did I not? If hell freezes over.
See, I think you're implying, though, that we're in hell.
No, I didn't mean that. No. Although some would argue that there have been recordings made of what hell actually sounds like. Have you ever heard them before?
I have.
In fact, I think I've got, yeah, I've got an audio soundbiter here. This is what hell is supposed to actually sound like, Matt.
I warn you, what you are about to hear is very disturbing indeed.
Now, for those who are unfamiliar, what you are hearing, of course, is one of many sound bites we're going to revisit here from the years that Art Bell hosted the Coast to Coast AM radio program. This particular audio soundbite, I've had a copy of that for years, because during his heyday, Art Bell, who we lost last week, Friday, April 13th, 2018, Art Bell had been retired for a number of years, living in Pahrump, Nevada. His home And, of course, that had been where he broadcast the program during his heyday. At the time that Art Bell was the host of Coast to Coast AM, it was syndicated by more than 500 stations. And in those days before podcasting, I mean, Art was kind of an innovator because he started in the late 80s and early 90s. Well, actually, that's not true. It goes back much further. Art Bell, I think, had been broadcasting in 1967 in Okinawa. And that's where he actually earned a Guinness World Record for longest solo broadcast in 1967. So he'd been broadcasting at least since the 1960s. In the 80s and 90s, he began doing a political talk format show in Las Vegas, Nevada. And he even wrote a book about his talk radio journey. The book was appropriately titled The Art of Talk. And in it, I think the entire thing, there's an uploaded version of the ebook that Art reads himself on YouTube. And it's well worth going and checking out.
Yeah, I may have to give that a listen.
Yeah. In that book, Art had said something along the lines of, you know, for the first 3 years that I worked in radio, I wasn't allowed to even come near a microphone and talk on it. And I remember something similar happening to me when I began in radio years ago. As I sit here talking into the Heil PR40, which I use as a tribute to Art Bell himself. That's the very reason I own this microphone, Matt. And I love it. And if you look up the pictures of Art over the years, you'll see he at times he used a radio or Electro Voice RE20 and other different microphones sometimes appear, but most often he was using a Heil PR40 like this. And the first time I ever spoke through one, I remember thinking, gosh, it makes me sound a little like Art Bell. Not really, but I mean, I do like the microphone now. So when I began in radio, the first day I was ever sitting in on a live radio broadcast at 570 WWNC, 570 AM Studios, Matt Matan was the host and the producer was Forrest Connor, and they let me just sit in and watch the broadcast. And at the end of the day, they told me, okay, well, you can come over and you can say your name. We'll let you say your name on the radio. Well, they'd been heckling me because I was the new guy. And being defiant as I always am, Matt, I go over to the microphone, and instead of actually saying, hi, my name's Micah, everybody, looking forward to meeting everyone, I get on the microphone, and I say, my name's Bond, James Bond. And they said, all right, you're cut off. And they wouldn't let me talk for 3 weeks. I was punished, but I was defiant, too. And that's when they said that they liked me. They said, we liked you because instead of coming in and playing by the rules, you immediately broke them. Your first day on the job, you
it's the way to do it, man.
No, I think it's not the way to do it. But, I mean, and the heckling that I would face, I remember I would be sitting there doing drive time radio, producing, running the board, and meanwhile, one of the other producers would sneak up quietly behind me and hold a lighter under my arm and try and light my arm hair on fire. I mean, it was a literal trial by fire in radio. But I survived, and we all became good friends. And the reason why is because, again, it is a very stressful environment working in radio, and that's why I think I'm befitted for this. I'll always be the guy behind the microphone because having gone through that, it just never leaves you. And Art talked about similar experiences.
Yeah, I think you've got to break the rules to a certain extent. I think Art did. You know, Howard does. A lot of these great people do it.
Well, yeah, and a lot of them tell very similar stories about their early days in radio. I have here in my hand a copy of another book written by Art Bell. I picked this one up somewhere. It's called The Quickening. Little did I know at the time that I bought it, it was actually signed by Art Bell. And so I've got a signed copy of The Quickening with Art's actual signature out there. So I'm all the more glad that I actually have that now. But so I have that here beside me as we continue onward into this segment, remembering Art Bell. I want to remember some of the most fun segments that ever appeared on his show. And incidentally, they are all call-ins to his radio program.
All the best are.
None of these are people who were guests who he had booked and came on. He would be doing open lines. Now, you got to keep in mind about Art Bell. Like me, Art was trained as a producer. And even though Matt works in the studio with me, moderates the chat room, helps me assemble segments and things, and he's working a lot of the system in this studio, I still have a board and 1, 2, 3, 4 computers over here on my side of the room. Most often, the host doesn't have all that kind of gear on his side of the room. But the reason I don't let Matt do everything is because when I was younger, I was trained as a producer, but I thought if I ever become a talk host, I want to be like Art Bell. Art produced his own show. He was actually working the board. Now, I very gradually over the years have allowed Matt to do some of that and others.
You know, graciously.
Yeah. And Race and Bill and other people, you know, back at Master Control. But, you know, and Art did too over the years. You know, he hired producers and he had people that would assist him with things. But, you know, from the early days, he had been a do-it-himself kind of a guy. He would build his own studio, he would produce his own show, and he would be his host, which made it very interesting when you're doing live radio and taking live calls, and you've got to be able to screen the calls. And so he had a unique system where, since he had to take the calls live and put them directly on the air, he wouldn't know the people's names. And so west of the Rockies, dial 1-800, you know, and do the number.
There's one we actually have where he goes, and to the Antichrist line. Like, well, he's got a line devoted to it. It cracks me up.
Well, what he would do is he had a wild card line, and every now and then he would do the east of the Rockies, west of the Rockies numbers, and then he would have a wild card line where people could call in, and from time to time he would say, I want to talk tonight to the Antichrist. Are you out there? If you are out there, I want you to dial in on our Antichrist line. Might as well go ahead and begin with that, because one night he does this, and I'll be darned if a guy claiming to be the Antichrist didn't actually call in.
Antichrist line, you're on the air. Hello.
Art.
Yes.
You called. You asked me to call. What do you need?
Do you claim to be the Antichrist?
Yeah.
Oh, then there's many questions that I have for you. First of all, how do you know that you are the Antichrist?
How dare you?
I dare.
Your preconceived notions of what the Antichrist is.
I don't dare.
Have a valuable opportunity to.
Okay, this stuff is gold. What's so horrible to me is that there are people who absolutely can't take a joke, and they took this sort of stuff so seriously. Bell was attacked. Oh my God. You know, PZ Myers tweeted the other day when he passed away, he said, Art Bell is now with the aliens. And then he tweeted an article that he'd written and everything, not very fondly remembering him. Yeah, sure, Art promoted a lot of fringe subjects on his program, but he did legitimately have an interest in them. He absolutely did. Just like, as we said earlier, Matt, you and I, we have a legitimate interest in UFOs or cryptozoology, and I really would like to see science applied to those kind of things. But newsflash, ladies and gents, if you are doing a podcast or a radio program and you aren't entertaining, you're kind of missing the ball. And these podcasts where people think that they have to be dry, straight, and serious the entire time, again, that's kind of against the entire idea of the performance art that is theater of the mind and radio. So while he did take the subjects seriously from time to time, Art really liked to play with people, which is why he would open the calls to people who claim to be the Antichrist.
To talk.
I was not even planning on coming out
to talk to the public.
Okay.
But this is the first show ever that said, will the real Antichrist please stand up?
That's correct.
I was very intrigued, and I, just as an aside, I must say you have an excellent show. I don't know if it was fate, but a couple of months ago, my cousin at a birthday party said she was listening to this unique man at night. And although I do work during the day, I wish I was on the beach, as the other guy said, drinking a margarita.
But well, that's what people imagine, but you know what people imagine is rarely true. And you're right, how dare I imagine to know what the Antichrist is? So you tell me.
What the Antichrist
is, what the Antichrist wants.
Is a man that comes along not by his choosing, just as Jesus was not by his own choosing.
That's right.
And I guess it was about the fourth or fifth grade that I was able to project myself over and have outer body experiences.
Yes.
When I was in junior high school, I started having global thoughts as far as getting a sense that. Now, this is really hard to explain, and I don't want to take up a lot of your time trying to explain the thought processes involved. But
he is the most conscientious Antichrist I've ever heard.
He's really polite.
He's really, really, I mean, he really likes Art's show.
Yeah.
He's a really friendly guy for an Antichrist.
God speaks through one person at a time during each generation. That person may not even know it. And every 500 years or so, that person feels it really strongly.
Anyway, you get the idea. So there were so many good shows that Art did. And again, the great question comes, I think in this instance, Art put it out there, and this guy actually calls in. For all we know, he may have thought he really was the Antichrist. For all we know, he may be out there listening to us now.
That's true. And I know we've got to cut some of these for, you know, time constraints. The best part of that one is where the Antichrist tells Art Bell's listenership, if I was you guys, I'd be buying gold right now.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, I need a t-shirt with that. I need to just, like, start buying gold. Like, quote, the Antichrist.
Yeah. I mean, again, the question I think that comes to mind, though, is how many of these callers were just calling in and trying to put people on, and Art was playing along with it, versus how many did Art have foreknowledge, maybe had coordinated with these people, and that these were sort of like segments that were put off as though an actual caller called in. Let's guess as we go along. I'm going to go to a couple of callers here. And again, let's just say that in the 1990s, Area 51 was a very popular subject. You know, with all the Robert Lazar stuff and I mean, any number of, you don't have to justify it. Area 51 was and still is a fascinating and popular trope within the whole UFO conspiracy subculture. And hence, there were more than one instance where callers called in claiming to have associations with it. The first we're going to hear from is a fellow who called in claiming that he was a pilot with a private aircraft, and he was going to fly over Area 51 and see what happened. And as you can imagine, all hell breaks loose.
Well, maybe if you're making a bad calculation, because if they're not listening, you're going to be shot down.
I don't know what he's going to do here. He's rocking his wings at me right now. He's rocking his wings, and he's cutting in front of me. And you know this. Don't cut in front of me now, because if he cuts that car, stay off. He can hear the vortex from his engine. I'm cutting with the engine. We're going to, just like twin tornadoes, if he gets too close, stay off, bro. Hold on there, I'm getting down on the deck. I'm going in, I'm getting down.
The guy is flying over Area 51 and describing in real time, allegedly, what's happening.
They didn't get me over there, they're not going to get me over here now. Looks like some kind of rail gun coming up out of that elevator, that flat area over there that the doors opened up. It's got some kind of a weird-looking barrel on it with a light. And, hell, they're doing something. They're shooting at me now. Oh, God. No, baby, I'm going in. I think I'm going in.
I'm not sure what we just heard.
Neither are we, Art. Neither are we. I mean, you know, anyone would take that stuff.
So deadpan.
He was just so good is what he was. He was the best. He was the best. Art Bell was the best. Listen, there was the other time, though, where the Area 51 caller, the alleged employee, called in. Yeah. Now, this one's really good.
Well, look, let's begin by finding out whether you're using this line properly or not.
Area 51.
Yeah, that's right. Were you an employee or are you now?
A former employee.
Former employee.
I was let go on a medical discharge about a week ago, and I've kind of been running across the country. Oh, man, I don't know where to start. They're going to... they'll triangulate on this position really, really soon.
You can't spend a lot of time on the phone, so give us something quick.
Okay. Okay. What we're thinking of as aliens are they're extra dimensional beings that an earlier precursor of the space program made contact with. They are not what they claim to be. They have infiltrated a lot of aspects of the military establishment, particularly the Area 51. The disasters that are coming, the government knows about them, and there's a lot of safe areas in this world that they could begin moving the population to now, Art.
But they're not doing anything.
They are not. They want the major population centers wiped out.
Now, that's one of the more controversial calls, and there's a lot more to it. What ends up actually happening is the broadcast goes down. You don't hear Art anymore, but the guy, you can still hear him frantically talking. There's a long period of silence, and then the backup generator starts, and the Coast to Coast theme starts playing again. And what they claim is that, and Art comes back on the air and says, I've never had that happen in all my years of broadcast. We were just taken down. Somebody took down the entire feed, and we went off the air. Well, a few nights later, apparently some people were kind of disturbed by this. And a few nights later, somebody called in and claimed that he was, in fact, the caller, and he recreated the frantic-sounding voice that he'd been doing. But a lot of sleuths out there in Radio Land had noticed that it didn't sound like the guy the first time. Maybe because he wasn't trying to be so in character. I don't know. And over the years, a lot of people might have come forward claiming to have been the Area 51 caller. We don't know really who it was, but Brian J.L. Glass, the comic book author, is the guy. He claims that he both was the original caller and the second caller, but he's not the only one. A lot of people over the years have claimed to have been the caller from Area 51 that night. In likelihood, he wasn't really from Area 51. How about this one? Here's a pretty creepy one. Okay. And this story, this audio soundbite is arguably one of the creepier things that was ever broadcast on Coast to Coast. It seemed that this was one of those instances where a legitimate call came in and the person just starts telling the story. And I'm just going to play this audio and we'll talk a little bit about it after this brief snippet.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Art.
Hello. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Ohio.
Ohio?
Yeah.
Right.
I live in a small farm town. And I'm currently writing a book based on my findings.
A book?
A book.
All right.
It all began when my grandfather was preparing to pass away back in 1990.
Preparing to pass away? You mean he knew he was going to die, and so...
Well, yeah, he was living in an old folks' home, and he had cancer that had pretty much eaten away at most of his body.
I hear you.
And pretty much most of the things that he said, people just took as... erratic rambling. But during his, last month or so, I spent a lot of time with him. And he used to be chief in the small farm town that I live in. And when I say small, I mean...
What do you mean chief? You mean police chief?
Chief of police.
All right.
And when I say small, I mean really small. Anyway, you have to forgive me because I'm scared to death just talking to you right now.
Don't worry about it.
He was telling me about an instance. He would lay on his bed and he would say, "All the children are dead."
All the children are dead.
All the children are dead.
Uh-huh.
And he looked at me, and he said, "Do you believe in monsters? Do you believe in demons?" I just thought, well, he's probably getting ready to pass over, and he's scared. He's questioning his own mortality. He's
right,
wondering where he's going from here.
Makes sense.
And then he began a story that began in 1966.
Now, the story that was told thereafter is rather weird. The guy said that essentially there were all these children, of course, that went missing in this town. And that apparently that at the river nearby, there had been a bunch of bodies that were found. And so they send some of the law enforcement from that little town down there, and there was this large building where the deputy sheriff had gone into and had seen this pile of bodies. And he was so shocked by what he saw, but then he was terrified when he noticed that there was something down there under the pile of bodies moving. He said it reminded him of like a if you watched a mole burrowing underground and you saw the earth rising, he said the bodies were rising as though there was something below them moving. And so he steps out and goes out the door as though he's going to leave, but crouches down in the darkness and waits, and he hears footsteps coming up out of this pit where these bodies were. And they come up this ladder, And he waits, and he doesn't know exactly what to expect, and then all of a sudden he sees a silhouette, and as it comes forward, he recognizes, presumably, the killer. It's his own 13-year-old son. And it's just a weird story, but, you know, the insinuation had been that there was something like a demonic possession or something like that.
Yeah, see, this was the only clip that we had in the show notes page today that I actually hadn't heard until earlier before the show. So this was all new to me, and I'm kind of sitting in my office like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Where is this going?
Well, the thing is that this is one of many stories which ended up being excerpted and featured in popular songs. There were songs every, you know,
I saw that.
Artists like Tool and a lot of other groups, mostly in the hard rock and metal genre, they have found these creepy sound bites from things that were broadcast on Coast to Coast over the years and have featured them as portions of audio in their shows. Art Bell has made cameos himself in different films and also in video games, more often than not in voice only, as though he is just, you know, broadcasting, reporting the news. There are video games. And what was the video game? I'm just drawing a blank on it right now, but Bell did a sequence where you're in the game, and as you're playing, there's a radio broadcast, and you can hear Art Bell broadcasting and reporting on, like, this zombie apocalypse thing. I'm sure Matt's going to find it for us, so when you find it, let me know. I've got two more sound bites here. We've already heard from the Antichrist, so I think we'll hear from JC. We had to get one from JC. JC was a heckler that would call into the program from time to time, and it was rather amusing. Of course, JC would often lambaste and attack Bell because of the unholy things that he would talk about. And JC happened to share the initials of a famous founder of Christianity. You probably know who I'm talking about. We've got JC giving Art Bell a hard time here.
Hello, Mr. Bell?
Yes.
All right, I got a couple things to say for you. I need to have some clarification on the fact that you don't believe you're talking about the government covering up UFOs and how they're trying to deceive us. And you're always talking about that. Then you try to come on and double talk us by saying that you don't think we're responsible for the government.
No, I say that we are the government.
Well, wait, what make of your mind? What do you mean we are the government? If we are the government, then why would they hide things from us? They are not hiding anything from us.
Even our founding fathers, sir, when they wrote that wonderful document we all live by.
Yes, the most wonderful piece of paper in this entire planet.
Cautioned us to keep our eye on them and put in all kinds of protections because...
Well, I don't think...
Excuse me, now let me finish and then you can go, okay?
All right.
And put in all kinds of protections specifically so because they understood that the government could get out of control.
Well, it could and it might and it would. It is not out of control. Our government is a great and beautiful thing. And people like you who try to tear it down and who try to rip down the foundations of our nation by purporting Bigfoot. I mean, I can't believe you. Bigfoot, you're a grown man and you're taking this serious.
I love
Bigfoot. What is wrong with you?
I love Bigfoot.
Oh, you know, don't get smart with me. You're just, you and your UFO nonsense, you're crazy.
I wish Bigfoot were my dad.
Oh, you know what? Bigfoot is of the devil.
You know, when he says that, I just want to say, you already are, Jables. You're my little baby squash.
I must have listened to this little snippet for like three times earlier. I just could not stop laughing at this.
The next time somebody gives me a hard time about my advocacy for the scientific search for Sasquatch, I'm just going to say, I love Bigfoot. I wish you were my dad.
And the video game was Prey.
Okay.
2006 computer game, apparently.
There you go. Yeah, where Art Bell made a cameo as himself. My favorite Art Bell call-in of all time. And again, I think with JC, who would frequently call in, and I'll say that some of the other callers even sounded sort of similar to him, I think that probably my hypothesis is that Art had a couple of people who would call in and they would just have a go at it with him from time to time. They would say, hey, look, you know, can you come on the show tonight, call in during the second hour, see if you can come up with a good yarn. And I don't think that he was above just doing some really fun content like that from time to time. There are other times where it's a little harder to tell. I don't think that, you know, the Antichrist calls and things like that were necessarily scripted or planned. But I'll tell you this. Bill was telling me that the game was called Prey as well. And Tiffany Max texting me telling me that her kids are going to have nightmares now. Hey, listen, again, this is all in fun, folks. Well, just having a little fun here, aren't we?
I've got to get in, though. The last part of that interview is the best. I almost cried. I was laughing so hard earlier because JC on the line there says, Art, why don't you just get off the air and make room for good, wholesome Americans like J. Gordon Liddy, Ollie North, and Rush Limbaugh? It's like, two of those men were convicted of federal crimes, by the way.
Which was probably part of the joke. One of my favorite call-ins ever was Mel Waters, who claimed that he had a hole on his property that went so deep, for all we know, it went all the way to hell. At very least, it went to Greater Heliopolis. We have audio.
When did you discover this hole?
Well, the hole has always been there. We've been out there for a couple of years now, and the hole has been there since we've been there. It's been there since the previous owner was there, and the previous owner there was quite elderly, and I'd say he was there for a good 30, 40 years before we moved in.
Wow.
And then
and so there's been a thing of throwing stuff down this hole for a long time.
It's been going on, for as long as the hole has been there, I assume.
When nobody knows that, I guess. All right. How do you pronounce the name of your town, Manistash?
Manistash.
Manistash.
Right.
Oh, that's right. Thank you.
Actually, I'm in... right now, I'm in a little town called Ellensburg.
Oh, I know Ellensburg. All right.
You must know about a rodeo here then.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Well, so, we've been there for several years. And, we take all of our trash, rubbish, anything we have that we have to get rid of, we take it, throw it in the hole. Everyone's throwing their stuff in the hole. The people from around there throw all the stuff in the hole. I mean, it's just been going on for a long time. Well, I got this thinking one day, how come this hole is not filling up? It must be an awfully deep hole.
That's a good thing to consider, sure, as you throw stuff in it for decades, literally.
And so, I used to be I would say pretty close to a professional shark fisherman. So I had a couple of huge fishing reels, went out there and started letting the line down. I figure after one...
Did you weight the line?
Oh, yeah. There's, in fact, the original line is still down there. I've just been adding to the line and keeping track of how much line I have used.
So over the years, Mel continued, presumably, to feed... I don't know if it was years, but I mean, there were several subsequent calls from Mel Waters. And what he said he did was he would keep feeding the monofilament fishing line down into the hole. Thousands and thousands and thousands of feet of it kept going down. And he said that he found no discernible evidence of the end ever being discovered. And as he would continue to call in and give these updates, the story got weirder and weirder. And eventually they tell this story about taking, I think it was a dead calf, I believe, and they throw it into the hole. Well, no, I remember. They lower it down, okay, on a rope, and then they bring it back up, and that this strange creature that sort of resembles a seal or something like that hatches out of it and sits there with human-looking eyes and looks at them, and everyone's standing around, and then it leaps back down into the hole. It got wilder and wilder and wilder. There was the time that the guy called in and claimed that he had been privy to an instance where a Bigfoot had been shot and killed, and that it was carried away by men in black suits. And then there were all the famous, not only researchers of the Fringe that were interviewed, but also celebrities, George Carlin, people like that would show up on the program.
Yeah, I started listening to that interview earlier today as well.
Yeah, I mean, Art, again, he was the art of talk. And talking was an art for him, especially when he took it to the airwaves every night, and people around the world would tune in and listen to his dispatches out there from the high desert where he did Coast to Coast AM. Art Bell will be greatly missed, a true pioneer in radio, and someone who I think brought so much fun, so much character, so much humor, and so much originality to that format. It really inspired generations of not only radio hosts, but also certain podcasters who would come in the years after the fact. And so we remember him fondly, send salutes, and wish him the very best as he makes his way to the great broadcasting booth and the ever after. This will be the final word for this week's edition of the Graylian Report. I want to thank all of you guys out there tuning in, and on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios, including Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Rayson, Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrail, Tiffany Mack, the lovely assistant Lauren, Matthew Oakley, and yours truly, I remain Micah Hanks, and we will catch you again next time here on the Graylian Report. In the meantime, as always, keep your eyes to the skies, and stay strange out there.
Been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.